Exactly what recording were you looking for?
Pavane in G by Ernest Vaughan and the Pan Symphonic Orchestra, 1963.
Good morning, Mr. Briggs. As usual, this recording will decompose 1 minute after the breaking of the seal.
Hello once again, and welcome to the IMMP podcast from the Intermillennium Media Project. My name is Matthew Porter.
And I'm Ian Porter.
I'm his dad, he's my son, and I've made him watch television once again.
Yeah.
What we do here at the IMMP is I force Ian to watch movies or television or read books or listen to music from my youth. And then we find out what he thinks about them, what I think about them, coming back to them decades later.
A fresh perspective, a returning perspective. Exactly.
And last week, we talked about a TV series that was extremely important to me when I was a kid. And that was In Search Of, presented by Leonard Nimoy.
Yes.
But now that we've talked about Leonard Nimoy, we have to acknowledge the earlier TV series, for which, to many people, he is much more famous.
Exactly. I knew he was in this one.
And this is the TV series. It started in 1966. It was popular at the time, but it's grown in popularity. It came back with a revival TV series with another generation of characters in the 1980s. It has given rise to a cinema franchise, feature films.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, we are finally talking about Mission Impossible.
Yeah, I was so excited when you handed me the folder with the pictures of the episodes we were going to watch. Absolutely. And this is one of those series I knew existed out there, and I knew it was so influential for so many people.
It has had so much influence. It affected television at the time. It's affected movies dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, I think it was, we kind of have to acknowledge, you know, who is this Leonard Nimoy person who shows up as the part, one of the selling points of In Search Of. Hey, the fact that he was on a TV series like this is a big part of that.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, this is one of those things that got his career moving in new directions. I mean, he even did directing work after this.
He did.
Three Men and a Baby.
That's right. Yeah.
Exactly.
So it's kind of hard to know where exactly to start with Mission Impossible, because it was so influential. It's not the first kind of storytelling of its kind. It drew from other things in pop culture. It's essentially a spy or counter-espionage series. So it, of course, fed from the James Bond mania that was going on in the 60s. But it also, it draws from movies like Top Kapi, which it was a heist movie, but it was about this collection of specialists coming together to succeed in a mission that should have been impossible.
Exactly. Do you want to see a bunch of unique characters with their own skill sets and perspectives tackle intense situations of drama and intrigue at different and exotic locations every time? And wrestle with some of the implications of the larger things they're dealing with as they do so. Mission Impossible does that.
It does. It does. So we started with, and this ran for many seasons, and we came to this because of Leonard Nimoy, but he was not in the first few seasons.
No, he came in later.
Right. He took over for another actor whom we've talked about before. We talked about him in a science fiction series called Space 1999.
Yes.
Martin Landau.
Martin Landau.
So Martin Landau and Barbara Bain, and they were married at the time they were making Mission Impossible. They were both in Mission Impossible before they were both in a Space 1999.
Yeah. And it's kind of fun to see, you know, that crossover between that dense sci-fi show and this spy action thriller, and seeing an actor do both of those styles and be able to bring gravitas to both.
There's a certain odd conceit that this show has, and they don't dwell on it as much in later seasons. But it starts out with the idea that this team that is assembled, there's a new team assembled for each particular mission. We happen to be seeing the ones that feature our recurring cast. But maybe I'm getting ahead of ourselves, because there's another way, a conceit that every single episode opens with. And that is receiving the assignment.
Which is so fun.
It is.
It makes me think that there's a really fun stage practice thing. I want to do like receiving the assignment as an actor training, just because you've got to go in and do something with supreme confidence. Like every single thing, it's like you have to go into this place and request a specific, like go into this cheese shop and request a specific kind of cheese with the confidence of someone who knows this is that important. And so if you don't have context that this was a sci-fi, science-y super spy environment, it would look insane. You start up a Mission Impossible episode and you skip the opening credits and you just show someone that without it, and they will be weirded out and lost for a good moment.
And sometimes these involve dealing with a person like you described. Sometimes it's just about going to a particular place and finding a thing that's been left there in a dead drop. But for example, one of them was he goes into a record store and requests a very specific recording, a specific classical piece, specific recording by a specific orchestra. And it's not just the person who requested this, but there's specific back and forth, call and response, sign and countersign between our lead secret agent guy and whoever is providing him with the mission. And in that example, what he gets is a record.
Yes.
That he has to peel plastic off and then play right away and listen to it while he goes through the pictures and documents that were also in the box. And the voice on the recording gives him what the mission is. You know, these pictures are so-and-so from some foreign country. Here's what's happening there. Here's the thing that has to be fixed or be done by your Mission Impossible force. And it's always your mission if you choose to accept it.
Yes.
These are dangerous missions. You have the option to say no.
There is a very, very clear power in that of setting up the authority and competence of our characters, because it's always done with this friendly hello first name of whoever's leading this team.
Yes. Because
it changes over time. And it's this entire setup. Your mission, so it's this entire setup, what's going on. Your mission, if you choose to accept it, is complete this task. As always, if any of your team are captured, the secretary will deny all knowledge of you.
Yes, and it's always, that is almost contractual, the way it's always very precise.
Mm-hmm.
If any member of your IM force are killed or captured, the secretary will disavow all knowledge of your actions. It's like, yeah. Sign here. And it is the IM force. It is the Impossible Missions Force. That's apparently their official name, because in some of these we see the head has a folio embossed with gold lettering saying Impossible Missions Force. It looks cool for television, but I'm thinking, given all the secrecy, maybe you don't want that in gold on your black leather folio.
Yeah. I will say it's fun for us, because for just this one episode, we get to be the Impossible Missions Media Project.
Oh, I like that. That's cool.
Yeah. Your podcast, should you choose to accept it.
And you're right. That leader of the IMF is, it changes over time. It starts out, it is a character named Dan Briggs, played by Stephen Hill. And later on, and I think more well known, is a Peter Graves, playing Jim Phelps as the head of the IMF. But what we get in some of these episodes, and again, it kind of falls off a little bit later on, is Dan Briggs going through this stack of essentially resumes. He's got photos and lists of people's backgrounds and special skills, and he's tossing some aside and tossing some in on the stack in front of him and assembling his team for this particular mission. And that's the great thing about this is it is a group of cooperating specialists. Everybody has the one thing they're really good at. And the mastermind's job is to know exactly what this mission is going to need, plan it all out, and know who he needs for which part.
And it's not just military dossiers. There are, you get the feeling that this has agents of all types in all places, and that they're all aware or known or invited in, but that the importance of the mission exceeds the requirements of enlistment.
Right. In some ways. Obviously, they're all vetted and they've been read in to some extent, at least about the existence of the IMF. But
we've got these pictures can be everything from military pictures to mugshots of known criminals, the covers of magazines for famous actors and models who need to be there for the distraction and the performance of someone. They've got like signs about like a strongman competition, I think, in one of the episodes. Because they need someone who can just lift a whole lot.
Yeah, Martin Landau plays Roland Hand, who is his day job is a stage magician. He's an illusionist, an escape artist, a makeup artist. He also has acting abilities. Cinnamon Carter, played by Barbara Bain, she is a top fashion model and actress, and she's usually getting in to play certain roles and distract people and persuade people. I do wonder about hers, though, in that she's usually just wearing expensive clothes, but it's her. And if their dossier on her are all the magazine covers she's been on, I would expect her to be recognized from time to time.
Yeah.
And then there's Greg Morris playing Barney Collier, who is their technical specialist. And Barney, he owns an electronics company. But he is an engineer and a technician who is extremely capable of inventing whatever they need invented and then performing whatever technical feats they need to change the technical environment wherever the mission has to take place.
He's their go-to engineering guy. Yeah.
And you mentioned weightlifting. We've got Willie Armitage, played by Peter Lupus, and he is a world record-holding weightlifter. So he's kind of a utility player, but he's mainly there in case some feat of strength is required, like lifting two nuclear warheads to carry them out in sample cases, which is what he has to do in that first story.
I will say one thing that gives it away, and they do a really fun job as he's tossing down these photos of this is when the actors' credits get revealed. Each of them gets shown as their photo is added to the team and to the stack. And this is also where you'll learn if there's a guest star for an episode.
Right. Because occasionally we do get somebody who is a guest star who's playing a character who has some specific talent needed for that particular mission. And sometimes it's just our usual cast.
Sometimes it's just our usual. But it was notable that all of our usual cast are the ones with color photos.
Yeah, yes, that is sometimes a little obvious. And there's something about that also reminds me, in terms of more recent media, of Global Frequency.
Yes.
Warren Ellis's comic series, and we saw a pilot of a never-produced television series based on that, and part of the conceit of that is there is this organization, the Global Frequency, but they have this huge database of people with skills who they may need to call on, and people who haven't even been vetted. So, and it gives the viewer, the reader, this idea that, oh, wow, someday my phone could ring, and it'll be the Global Frequency who happens to need somebody with my skills. They happen to need someone who has a ridiculous knowledge of obscure 90s anime. fine, I'm your guy. Sign me up.
We need 27 miniatures printed within the next 3 hours. Oh, perfect. That's why you called.
So there is a little bit of that in the way that they select the IMF team for each mission.
Yeah. And each mission has its own challenges, and they are good at making our heroes skilled, but not perfect. Something I had to work through is that they get in there with a lot of foreknowledge. Some of these episodes, I was like, they know too much to begin with. This doesn't sound like they're keeping the challenge in it, but they're very good at making sure that these stories are written with twists and turns and curves and changes to them.
And it makes sense to me when you think about it that they have a lot of intel, in that the IMF is not an intelligence gathering organization, really.
Yeah,
They are there to achieve some particular result. They are an executive kind of force. And that implies that there is some knowledge of what is happening and what needs to be done. And all the detail that we get in the mission assignments that that the leader gets, it suggests that, you know, the CIA or the FBI, the NSA, and these other traditional intelligence gathering organizations have gotten all this information, and analysts have put it all together, and they know exactly what's happening, and they know what has to happen or be prevented. And these traditional agencies have no idea how to make that happen. It's like,
exactly.
Yes, we know that so-and-so in this generic Latin American country is going to do such and such a thing, and we need to stop them to make sure that the appropriate rightful person winds up taking power as per their constitution. We have no idea how to make that happen. That's when they call the IMF. Here's all our intel. You guys make it happen.
That also does lead to this variety in the mission type is just things no one else can get done. There are missions where it's like, we need you to go into a place and remove an object. Okay. Or we need you to go in and make a guy give a specific speech. Or some of these where it's like, you are playing a different person and you're doing an infiltration. And so suddenly we're watching actors play actors acting. And the levels of meta start to peel in on themselves in fun ways.
And that brings up one of the probably best known tropes of Mission Impossible, which is the preternaturally perfect disguise makeup. Not just disguise, yes, but their ability to make a member of the IMF look and sound exactly like one of the people who they have to fool or who they have to use to fool someone else. So there's always somebody with that particular skill in the group. It starts out as Martin Landau. Later on, when Martin Landau leaves the series, that role is taken on by Leonard Nimoy, playing a guy named Paris.
Yes.
Who, again, is a magician, impressionist, actor, illusionist, for a similar character. A
very similar setup.
Yeah. And that whole idea, the classic bit of the person taking off the latex mask, and, oh, it's really Roland Hand, it's not so-and-so.
Did the person take the mask off themselves? It's Mission Impossible. Did the person take the mask off someone else? It's Scooby-Doo.
Oh, that keeps that very clear. I like that.
Yeah.
It kind of seems to me that it took them a while to figure out the easy way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the first episode, the pilot, they have to interfere with a Latin American dictator giving a particular speech, and they part of their plan is to have Roland, Martin Landau, disguised as the dictator. And the way that they do that is they have the dictator played by Martin Landau in makeup,
yes,
in heavy appliance type makeup. So then, and he looks weird. It's not, I have
he
to admit,
does.
It's not great makeup. He just looks just bizarre. And yet, it's, wow, this general looks bizarre. And Martin Landau's character in the makeup that he's putting on to pretend to be the general is equally bizarre, identically bizarre.
Exactly.
How convenient. It seems like it wasn't until later that they realized we can have the person he's disguised as play him in disguise.
Disguise, exactly.
And that is what makes it look like the perfect disguise.
And they are good about making sure that it's never it's never extreme. They've never got, like, the Arnold Schwarzenegger character playing the Betty White character in somehow latex makeup. They're never going unbelievable in that level, but they are doing some fun switcheroo stuff.
Yes.
And who's playing who.
Yeah, there's one I'm looking up here.
And even their mask-based tech is very clever. There's a lot of interesting patching into phone lines and scrambling local radio signals, or planting a bug as you walk past a place so that you can listen into something.
And that's what Barney is so good at.
He'll
take over somebody else's closed circuit television system and splice in other things, or or arrange for a delay that allows them to do very specific stuff. And the things that Barney gets to do and how technically advanced they are improves and gets more impressive over time. And over time, we see him do more and more invention and creation of things before the mission, creating some special mobile camera, some other piece of technology that has never existed in the world, but this is what they need for the mission, so Barney invents it.
Here's a special drill that moves slow enough, but is sharp enough that it can cut through a wall without triggering sensors, things like that.
Yeah, there's one episode which is, if there's anything they do is truly impossible, this is it.
Yes.
They have to train a cat to perform certain things on command. It's this, they've got to retrieve a carved jade seal out of a museum case and have the cat take it and walk it back across a temporary bridge they've created so as not to set off the motion detectors. And Barney has rigged this. It just seems like it's a microphone in that there's a little speaker on the cat's collar and Barney can talk into it and the cat can hear him. But he's trained this cat. And I don't know, training a cat to do anything you want it to that's the impossible part. I just kept expecting the cat to stand there at the museum case, stare at Barney while he slowly pushes this jade seal off of the table and onto the floor.
Yes.
But hey, impossible mission force. They trained a cat.
But that's the sort of scenarios we're getting here, where it's, you know, stealing back things. It is a perfect, it's a wonderful mix of heist and espionage work.
Yes. One that we watched, The Mind of Stefan Miklos.
Oh, that one was weird.
Was incredibly complicated. And that's one thing about this series. This is a series from the late 60s, early 70s that trusted its audience to be able to follow extremely complicated plots and to take enjoyment out of following those extremely complicated plots. The Mind of Stefan Miklos was, there was an enemy agent in the U.S. who... Oh, there was an American agent who turned out to be working for the enemy. And see, I'm even losing track. But essentially, they had somebody who had turned, and they had been feeding this person bad information because they knew he was feeding this information to the enemy. And someone on the enemy side figured out that he was actually getting bad information because the Americans had figured out that he was really working for us. So the Impossible Mission Force had to convince this high-level enemy spymaster that the person who was telling him that this agent was no longer trustworthy was lying.
Yes.
So they had to set him up in a way that made it obvious to the super intelligent spymaster that he was being set up, but not make it too obvious or he'd know something was going on. It was the weirdest thing. I'm incapable of describing it briefly as much as I'm trying to, but it was so intricate and it was all down to little details about whose lighter was where. And they set this path that people had to follow very, very exactly because they knew the enemy spymaster was going to follow all of these clues. So they made sure they left these subtle seeming clues to lead him in the direction they wanted.
If anyone wants to experience a version of the complexity of that episode without watching it, might I suggest the game 5D Chess with Multiverse Time Travel on Steam? Because that's that is the same level of weird and wild, consistent complexity we're dealing with. This is chess games upon chess games. It's that episode had me pausing and going back just to figure out what was going on at least twice.
And one of the Leonard Nimoy episodes we watched was called The Robot, or maybe it was just Robot.
Robot. Oh, goodness, that one.
And that was fun because of all the different roles that Leonard Nimoy had to play. He had to pretend to be the sickly head of a foreign country who was being undermined by someone who wanted to take control of this country and align it with the Eastern Bloc instead of remaining neutral. So Leonard Nimoy's character, Paris, had to pretend to be the sick leader, had to be, had to pretend to be the guy who the bad guy had hired to pretend to be the Sick leader, the Gemini yes. double, had to pretend to be a robot that was supposedly going to replace the leader and give the speech the bad guy wanted the leader to give.
And then in the end had to play the aging dictator again, but newly confident and pretending to be the robot. Which was just, that was wild. That one was wild and confusing in a different way, but that's because it was a quick-paced thing. Like, the turns happened so swiftly sometimes.
And that's one in which they do take the easier approach for at least some of their disguises, in that they have him, he has to disguise himself as the bad guy's right-hand man, a general, played by Larry Linville, known to a lot of people from MASH. And there they had Larry Linville playing Paris in disguise as the character Larry Linville played. Much better yes. way to do the, and they have the classic, the cutaway. You see Larry Linville start to peel something off his neck, and then they cut to another angle, and in which you see Leonard Nimoy pulling the latex off of his face.
I know companies that could use this show as an advertising chance, because they sell professional costume makeup, and I'm just like, this show could be sponsored. I know these companies.
Another guest star it's worth mentioning in the one about that jade seal was Darren McGavin, who we know as Kolchak the Night Stalker.
Kolchak
also plays the bad guy in The Natural.
Okay. Oh yeah.
So yeah, he has this kind of sinister presence to him that works very well for bad guys, and it worked very well for Kolchak because Kolchak was never really an up and up hero. Where he became heroic when he had to.
There's a lot of people in this that in episodes, because this is one of those shows that gets to have a variety of casts for the different places and people.
Yep.
There's a lot of people we know from other stuff. A lot of people we saw in Columbo when we watched that series. So many, all roads lead to Columbo. Everyone's been on Columbo eventually.
Yeah, Edward Asner was in one of these as an enemy double agent in America. It really was one of those series that they needed guest stars in every episode, because at very least you had to have the person where our group is trying to fool.
Yes.
And they had to be good actors. They had to be people who could establish a character and hold the screen head to head with the characters we had known and gotten to be familiar with over the course of years in some cases, and with actors who had that much time to develop these characters. You put an Ed Asner, you put a Darren McGavin, you've got somebody who can fill those shoes.
Exactly. There was the episode we watched where they're infiltrating this one was funny, that they're infiltrating a base run by the enemies, vaguely as to who it is, I believe.
Yeah.
But it is a fake American town, because they're training their agents to pretend to be Americans so that they can infiltrate places in America. And they're figuring out why and what they're doing.
So our team goes in, our team of Americans goes in pretending to be American agents who are learning to pretend to be American. Oh, no. Our team of American agents goes in pretending to be Eastern Bloc agents who are learning how to pretend to be Americans so that they can come and do things in the United States.
And so you're intentionally watching people act and make mistakes in their acting so precisely that no one doubts their acting, because the point is that they're supposed to be acting.
Right. They want to seem like the elite agents who are selected for this mission by the bad guys, and yet they want to be imperfect just enough to show that they're still learning.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating.
And that one had a guest star, too.
That did, yes. What's his name? I know I've seen him before. George Takei played a temporary member of a member of this particular IMF force. He was there because he was like a biology specialist and an epidemiologist.
Where do I recognize him from? He was Kaito Nakamura in Heroes.
Yes.
That's where I know him from. That's what he's. Yes, absolutely. I knew him from somewhere. But it was fun to see these kind of things. And I love that kind of thriller action thing. So this honestly was very interesting to see like short individual versions of that over and over. That's a style that is so rife with possibilities. I will say there's repetition in there. We watched just a few episodes and there's a whole lot of small nations in places that aren't going to last very long, that have a dictator of one form or another that are being systematically removed.
And yeah, they're not super creative with their place names. Most of these operations happen in small Latin American countries or small Eastern European countries. So like the Latin American countries, for example, we get Santa Costa and Terra Nueva. And yeah, like somebody paging through a freshman Spanish book coming up with place names.
It's that.
And that's one thing about this is that, of course, everything happens in English.
Everything happens in English.
When they're in an Eastern European country and, you know, some of the signage is in Cyrillic and such, everybody, including the bad guys talking to each other in scenes in which no one else is present, that's all happening in English. They're in Terra Nueva or Santa Costa in Latin America, where you would think everybody would be speaking Spanish. They're speaking, everybody is speaking English. That bothered me until I realized, you know, we're watching a TV show for an American audience. Of course, they're speaking English. That doesn't necessarily mean the characters are speaking English. They make it clear that one of the things that all of these IMF candidates have in common is a facility with languages, and that they each speak many languages. So you got to figure that they all speak fluent Spanish, and they all speak fluent Russian and other Eastern languages. Mm-hmm. So they're the TV series is functioning as a kind of a universal translator, where we are hearing everything in English because we're the English-speaking audience. And we can imagine, okay, they're speaking Russian because they're dealing with Russian agents in a Russian country.
Yeah, that's one of those, there's a suspension of disbelief for TV aspect that has to come in here, as well as the how fast and the what they have on hand kind of stuff. And there's that the sense of the entirety of the universe is leaning sometimes towards our heroes, because that's the point.
And they've got to make our heroes look like superheroes. They're so competent, they're so talented, and they plan things towards their own strengths so incredibly well. And yet every single story has to have a turning point, a reversal, something where something goes terribly wrong and it looks like our heroes are done for. But they almost never make that connected to any kind of a mistake made by our good guys. They always manage to make that happen because of maybe it's something unexpected, but it's also just the other human factors make different decisions. It's all very good because every single episode has that reversal, has that, oh my goodness, moment. Mm-hmm. And yet it's never because, oh, somebody saw through Paris's disguise, or the sleight of hand that Roland worked, or somebody recognized Cinnamon Carter from a magazine she'd been on. At least none of the ones that I recall has that.
You know, those things that should possibly pop up never do.
Yeah. The cat never decides to act like a cat at just the wrong moment.
It's remarkably dog-like. I just feel bad for the filming crew, because they had to film that cat until the cat guy right. Ugh.
And it was tough to know which episodes to watch for this, because it was on for 7 seasons, even before we get to the 1980s revival. So we picked a few episodes. We wanted to make sure we included some Leonard Nimoy episodes.
Yes.
And we wanted to watch the pilot.
Mm-hmm.
And there are so many websites out there that have selections of, have recommendations of the best Mission Impossible episodes. I looked at some of those, but I think that what we arrived at was a pretty good cross-section, because it had some of the acting stuff, it had a lot of the technical stuff. There was one in which Barney was captured and was poisoned by some kind of a nerve agent, and they needed to get to Barney and save his life, but also complete the mission and prevent the bad guy country from producing tons of this nerve agent, and they had to recruit another computer specialist because Barney was incapacitated.
Mm.
And that was one where they had difficulty recruiting the person they needed. And they used some pretty questionable, heavy-handed tactics to quote-unquote persuade him to,
yes,
to join their team for this mission.
There's parts of the way they do some of this, those sort of things that remind me of the getting the team together scenes from another movie we've seen for the podcast, which is The Italian Job.
Yes, yes.
There's very much some parallels there about the way these interact and the way there is, like, you can, every, by showing even episodes like that, one person being brought in, it implies there's a story of possibly that depth for each member.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, for most of them, it seems like they want to be there. Yes. Roland Hand seems to enjoy the challenge of playing these different roles and using his magic for something practical. Cinnamon seems to enjoy the opportunity to travel the world and to beach her charming self, but for a particular purpose, and to persuade people to behave in the ways that they need them to behave. Even Barney seems to like the technical challenges that this brings.
Oh, yeah.
But it does make sense that not everybody with the skills they need would necessarily be on board with doing this. And does that mean, I would imagine most of the time, they go find somebody else who has these skills, who wants to take part. But in this one, they had a particular set of skills that were needed, and they had someone who had those and more, who was in the right place at the right time, and they didn't have time to find someone else who could do the job.
Yeah, there's... Mm-hmm.
But that still leads them to resort to planting evidence and kidnapping loved ones and kind of going overboard about recruiting this person.
Yeah. It's interesting to see how that one is and think about how that gets portrayed.
But it always does still come down to this group of specialists all cooperating in something. And that's where, for me at least, Mission Impossible had another influence. And that is an influence on the way I always thought about Dungeons and Dragons.
Yes.
Because talk about something that is based on the idea of specialists who are cooperating to do something.
This is absolutely how you build and how you operate a team like that. I agree. Honestly, this is the sort of story I always want to play in tabletop games, regardless if it's D&D fantasy or not. Like, I want to run one of these sort of stories with the mission and everything.
Yeah. Well, I think we might be approaching our final questions about this.
I think we are.
Now, so stay tuned for those final questions and answers. But first, if you would like to support the Intermillennium Media Project and help make it possible for us to keep doing the podcast, help make it possible for me to continue subjecting Ian to old media, both good and bad, you can do that in a few ways. One is you can support us on Patreon, and that's at patreon.com/IMMproject. There's also a link on our website, immproject.com. And if you do support us on Patreon, you get additional audio content, and you get access to special parts of our Discord. And if you join us at the movie club level, you also get a surprise DVD in the mail periodically, so you can join in with Ian in being surprised and confounded by old media.
Come experience what I get to experience. And there is something very Mission Impossible about getting a different DVD or VHS or whatever with instructions to watch it on a regular basis.
Oh,
sent to you via the post. It's excellent stuff.
And that's something I don't know that we mentioned. The tapes or other recording media that these messages come in, they always self-destruct at the end. You know, this recording will self-destruct in 5 seconds. The DVDs we send you as a member of the IMM Project Movie Club will not self-destruct.
Exactly.
You might want to break some of them, but they won't self-destruct.
Hey, that's an interesting quandary about the destruction nature of that.
And as far as supporting the podcast, as always, the best way to support us is also to tell people about it. Rate us on iTunes, leave a review, just tell your friends. If you want more of the Intermillennium Media Project, you can also get that at our website, immproject.com, which has all of our back episodes. You can enjoy those as well as the bonus content you'd get on Patreon. And also on our website, you will see a link to our Discord. We'd love to hear from you there, and a contact page where you can send us email and where you can get our P.O. box if you want to send us honest goodness physical mail, like don't send us anything self-destructing via the U.S. mail.
No. And yeah, let's be nice to our carriers and not do that.
And Ian, where can people find you online?
I can be found online at itemcrafting.com, as itemcrafting live on Twitch, and as itemcrafting at bluesky.social.
And you can find me at bymatthewporter.com. You can also find me on YouTube as bymatthewporter, where you'll find things like my trip to Roswell, New Mexico, or my ongoing series of Draft House Diaries, where I review movies and movie theaters and movie theater food.
Uh-huh.
And you can, anything else we needed to mention? I guess not.
Not specifically.
Yeah, so that would cover it. And we appreciate your listening. We appreciate any support you can offer. Mm-hmm. Now, final questions. Revive, reboot, or rest in peace?
Well, there's one before that, Dad.
What's that? Oh, screen or no screen?
Binge or no binge.
That's right, it's TV. So, TV. Our final questions. TV series, so binge or no binge?
I'm goading binge. I love this kind of series. This kind of series is something I already knew I loved, and I've been excited to do this episode for a while because I know I like this kind of thing. This is an origin point for some shows I love, like Leverage.
Oh, yes.
Which I know we've mentioned before. Leverage takes so much from Mission Impossible in a wonderful way. And shows like that sort of show and that sort of style are my sort of thing. So I was delighted to get to watch this. I knew I was going to be saying binge early on. I was only worried it would somehow be terrible, and it wasn't. So it's excellent.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I do torment you with bad TV sometimes, but I figured you would enjoy this. And I say binge as well. It still holds up. There are things about it that make it clear that this is a TV series from the late 60s or from the early 70s. Sometimes the costumes, the makeup that our master of disguise has to put on lean towards yellow face and things like that. And not to excuse those, but they're part of television of the time. But those things notwithstanding, the stories, the acting, so much of it really does hold up.
Why in my head am I just imagining the IMF having to invade something made by Sid and Marty Krofft?
Hello, Mr. Phelps. This is a picture of the leader of a small nation named Lidsville.
Exactly.
You and your Impossible Missions force must steal this ring from his right-hand person, the genie.
Yes, oh goodness.
So many possibilities.
So many possibilities.
So yeah, it sounds like we're both saying binge on this one.
We're both saying binge. It's fun. It's not always perfect, but even when it's cheesy moments can be delightful. It's exciting moments are exciting. It's excellent. It's good popcorn kind of watching.
It is. And almost every episode you'll find something, you'll notice something where, oh, that's where that came from. I've seen that in so many TV shows and movies since then. It may have originated in Mission Impossible.
Exactly.
And it's also, as you were pointing out earlier, that fun spot the guest star. Where do I know him from? Oh, yeah. He's from Mary Tyler Moore.
So this leads us to our next question, which is revive, reboot, or rest in peace? This one, we've got to acknowledge some big pieces here.
Yes.
It did get a revival, big, well-known revival. In 1988, Mission Impossible revival TV series.
Right, with Peter Graves once again playing Jim Phelps, head of the IMF, but with another team of IMF operatives, the son of Barney Collier.
Yeah, that only got two seasons and a grand total of 35 episodes.
And I saw some of that when it aired, and it was fun. It was good. I don't know that it was quite as sharp as the original series. Aspects of it seemed dated because they were going to an old formula so many years later. But it was fun. And I think it was largely produced in Australia, which changed the production as well. But I enjoyed the episodes of that I saw back when it aired.
The bigger revival has been the Mission Impossible movie series.
Yes.
Which take the Mission Impossible concept, from what I understand, and run in a bit more of a National Treasure and late Fast and the Furious kind of direction, stylistically.
Yes, that's a good description. And I saw the first one of those not long after it opened and disliked it intensely, mainly because of how they treated the character of Jim Phelps, who was not played by Peter Graves in that version.
Mm-hmm.
But once later on, I came back to it, I watched the other movies, I thought, okay, putting that aside, how are these on their own? And, you know, they're forgettable but impressive action spectacle movies with some fairly good performances.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen any of those?
I have not, actually. They've been movies I've been told I might enjoy, but I'm also... It's never grabbed me because it's always seemed to be more spectacle than espionage.
Yeah, that's probably fair. In terms of what the movie emphasizes, that's about right.
Mm-hmm. I am fascinated by the fact that Mission Impossible has been... All of these are still related to each other. They still interact in different ways.
Right. They're all supposedly in the same continuity. The movies are supposedly in the same continuity as the TV series.
And this, of course, Mission Impossible has been known for its TV theme song, Plenty.
Oh, yes, yes.
That's shown up in all sorts of places. It's one of those quintessential spy sound effects. I'm also fascinated by the fact that there's video games.
There are?
Like, there's an NES video game from 1990 about the reboot show.
Oh, wow. Now, I could picture an FMV game or something, but an NES game?
Yeah.
It's harder to picture.
An NES game, there's an N64, a Game Boy Color, and all of these are like other side mission-y things, I take it.
Interesting.
This is one of those oddly cohesive stories. And that makes it a hard question, where there's an active, like, there's another movie coming out, active chronology and continuation going on. It's odd to say one of our options, but my response is actually to want to say reboot or revive again. I'm not sure which, but I'm thinking specifically as a TV series.
Here's something that, you know, I you're right in that we're getting the continued revival, whether we like it or not. Is there anything else we would like? Something that would interest me would be a revival in that it's taking place in the same continuity, but it is a period piece. And it is set in the late 60s, early 70s. And okay. It is happening concurrently with the TV series as we know it. And what we are seeing, and maybe this would be like a series of TV specials or something, the other IMF missions, because we so often see him sorting through this giant stack of potential IMF operatives and choosing the ones for this mission, and they tend to be all our main cast members. And maybe that's because the only ones that we're seeing in the TV series are the missions that feature these people.
Yes.
And that means that in between, maybe there are other missions in which Hill's character is selecting another set of IMF operatives, or in which Jim Phelps needs a different set of specialties. So you could do a series of Mission Impossible stories in which you have the leader, but the rest of the cast changes, or almost all the rest of the cast changes, every single mission. And that also gives the writing and directing challenge of a different collection of specialties.
That could be fun.
Maybe we don't need an electronics expert for this one, but we need a master chef.
Ooh.
Maybe we don't need a master of disguise, but we need the most well-informed architect in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
All of these possibilities, so many different specialties and expertise there could be.
I like that. I just feel like there's a lot more potential for that episodic style, absolutely. So the idea of maybe going back time-wise to give yourself the space could be very great. And it's easy to say, oh, do a new one set now with all our new technology and new scenarios. But going back gives you some interesting opportunities to let modern actors play things then, have limitations on the spycraft that you wouldn't have thought of. Those could be very good. Mm-hmm. And it lets them, if they want to keep everything consistent, if they want to keep everything supposedly in a continuity, let it be in the continuity.
Right.
By giving us those other stories. I would also love, especially if you're going to go back then, to show us the IMF is an American force. What happens when you're in the middle of a mission and you realize there's a set from the French equivalent?
That's a good point.
On the mission you're on.
Yeah.
And now you're just getting in each other's way.
Uh-huh.
Or what happens if there is an ally that the IMF is lent to, but something changes mid-mission, and now you're exposed because of the planning, trying to manage that? There's a lot of interesting layered options. I don't know if, honestly, there's so many episodes. I don't know if they tackled any of these, but I'd be interested to see them. And if not, I'd be interested to see them.
And that's another way in which setting it at a time when information transfer and access was so much more limited, the technology was so much more limited, gives you more challenges story-wise. It's not as easy as, you know, sending an encrypted message to let everybody who needs to know something know something. And something else that this kind of format with a different IMF team for each mission, something else that that format would do is the warning, the danger that we is pointed out every single time. If any member of your IMF team is killed or captured, the secretary will disavow any knowledge of your actions. This suggests that that is not something that never happens.
Yeah.
That IMF operatives can be killed or captured. So if you're not making a TV series where you need the same cast every week, well, I mean, we know that in season one, Martin Landau's character is not going to be killed because he's still in the cast. If it's a different set of characters every time, you never know who's going to survive to the end of that mission. And that heightens the tension.
You could pull an original CSI and introduce us to an entire crew in a two-part first episode. And then at the midpoint, that team is caught. And the crew we actually are going to get to know better are the ones sent in to recover whatever they can.
Interesting.
As a second mission
right.
in episode two of the two-parter. And that could be dark and interesting way to set the stakes and tension early.
Oh, it could, because I could certainly see where your mission is to retrieve the information or material that the first team had gotten their hands on. If you can rescue that first team, fine, but that is tertiary compared to the main mission objective.
Exactly. Now, first, step one, make sure none of our info escapes. Step two, complete their mission. Step three, save them if you've got time.
Right.
That right there. Oh.
So there's so many things you could do with this formula now that we have the world that Mission Impossible has established.
Exactly. I was excited. This was a fun one to see overall, good. Though.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it. It was fun to come Absolutely. Back to this. I haven't seen these in so long.
Oh.
This is a show that I was really too young to be interested in it when it first aired.
Okay.
I was 1 year old when it premiered. Or less than that. So I saw this in reruns in the late 70s and even into the 80s. It was on reruns and then on cable TV quite a bit. So I certainly have not seen all of this series, but I saw it in batches or binges later on. And it's so immersive and it's so influential.
It's just that it's a powerful, influential show.
And without that, who knows? Maybe Leonard Nimoy would never have gotten In Search Of. So we have that to thank as well.
We've got that to thank. So many people who were able to get so far and had such interesting interactions here with this.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed this, Ian. And listeners, I hope that you enjoyed this. We had a lot of fun watching this and talking about it. And
absolutely.
And as always, we appreciate you listening, and we will be back in a couple of weeks with more tales of media from the 20th century.
In the meantime, go find something new to watch.
As always, should you or any of your IM force be caught or killed, the Secretary will disavow any knowledge of your actions. This tape will self-destruct in 5 seconds. Good luck, Jim.